subjects looked at 90 pictures on a computer screen. 30 were classified as neutral, people, places, and objects. 30 were deemed pleasant. 15 of babies, families, and cute animals. 15 of erotica. And 30 were unpleasant, depicting threat and mutilation. When the people looked at these images after their half-hour sit, their anxiety levels returned to what they'd been at the beginning of the session. But when they looked at the images 15 minutes after exercising, their anxiety levels remained lower. Having recently finished a workout appeared to give them a bulwark against emotional manipulation. Bidwell finds that a prolonged post-run calm carries through her stressful work days. "It's kind of a reset," she says about running in the morning. "If I've gone for a good run in the morning, I'm fine at 2 p.m. if things are going haywire. I'm handling them a lot better. I'm less worried about them. I'm not heading into crises about why am I here. If I'm feeling anxious and worried about stuff and go for a run, it fixes that. But it's also more useful as a preventative everyday thing." Think different. When people talk about clearing their mind with a good run, they can mean getting rid of thoughts that have bedraggled them for the last however many hours. That can happen both because of distraction, gosh, look at the pretty flowers, or focus. The most important thing in the world right now is that I run this fifth 800-meter repeat as fast as the first four. Meredith Anderson says, "More often than not, when I come back from a run by myself, whatever thoughts were nagging me aren't there anymore, and I didn't do a ton of work to get there. It's not like I was doing a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy and challenging those negative thoughts. It was the running that made the difference." Heather Johnson says only running produces a zone-out effect, kind of like when you're driving and 10 minutes pass, but you don't remember it. But clearing the mind can also come not so much from erasing previous thoughts as from getting clarity on them. This mobile magic was consistently cited as a main appeal of running when I talked to people with anxiety. Cecilia Bidwell puts it this way. "When I'm running, the thoughts come in and out, and I'm not worried. I can think about things objectively. Things that I'm thinking are a huge deal, I realize, aren't a big deal in the scheme of things." Johnson says, "Running is the best cure for the swirling thought storm in my head. I can literally start a run where my head is buzzing the entire time, bouncing from one thought, problem, conversation to the other. But by the end, it disappears. It's how I resolve my internal conflicts or work out problems." Clinical psychologist Laura Fredendahl agrees that running is a great escape from rumination. When we're overwhelmed with anxiety and depression, shifting from the big picture, all the frustrations, worst-case scenario thinking, to the small, in-the-moment task of doing something that approaches a goal, like running a 4-mile loop with two hills, will kick off a positive feedback loop that continues throughout the run and takes our thinking and emotions out of the trench of negativity. Ekakakis believes the think-different benefit of running is likely a combination of two factors. On the one hand, neurotransmitters that promote a pleasurable sensation and help you put a positive spin on things, he says, citing endocannabinoids, which have a similar chemical structure to the active ingredient in marijuana, and which we'll look at in depth in the next chapter. Second, the circulatory system changes that happen with moderate exercise. In particular, it's probable that more oxygenated blood going to the prefrontal cortex of the brain is key. The prefrontal cortex helps with rational thinking. Greater activity there should logically lead to the clarity on otherwise troublesome topics that Bidwell and others regularly experience while running. Anxiety about the thing that usually helps with your anxiety. Most of the people I talked with about this topic said that running is a respite from anxiety. Bidwell, for example, says, "Most of my friends who are less anxious than me usually are far more anxious about their race times than I am. If a workout doesn't go well, or if I have to cut a run short, I'm like, it is what it is. But not everyone is able to be so nonchalant. There's a really, really fine line for me leading up to a big race with managing my anxiety, Ian Kellogg says. Am I going to approach this race with a positive, intentional attitude, or am I going to let it control me from 2 weeks out? There have been times when I've let it control everything that's going on in my mind. I have trouble focusing in school, trouble going to bed, things like that, because I'm constantly anxious or waiting around for this one event. Anderson says, anxiety was the main reason for me not running well in high school and college. I know that most people get nervous before races, but with the nervousness came the negative thoughts, like, it's not going to go well. Her dread of the race would build in the few days before, peaking as she was standing on the start line. During races, she says, the negative thoughts would come when I got tired. That's when things could really turn. Negative thoughts then were harder to come back from. Kellogg says that not managing anxiety cost him a chance at a school record. At an indoor meet, he was in the fast heat of the mile. The race would almost certainly be won faster than Otterbein's record of 4 minutes 14.5 seconds. The pack went through the first 400 meters in 65 seconds, a little slower than Kellogg's goal pace. Instead of understanding it would wind up and people would soon start to go faster, I panicked, he says. I told myself I'm not a good kicker. I surged to the front and hammered the middle 800 meters and then fell apart the last 400. The race wound up being won in the time Kellogg wanted to run. He was 6 seconds back in 4 minutes 20 seconds. I was surprised to hear Anderson's stories of pre-race dread. Now in her late 30s, she's one of the most enthusiastic road racers I've ever met. The difference, she says, is that she's now running and racing solely for herself. In school, there was some kind of pressure that I put on myself because of being on a team, that I had to do well and I couldn't mess up, and what would people think if I did, which became a self-fulfilling prophecy. Kellogg has learned to better manage running-related anxiety by changing his pre-race routine. I used to put headphones on and get super hyped up, but that causes me to psych myself out and overthink the race, he says. Now he tries to stay as calm as possible by joking around with his teammates. He continues, I still get very nervous before races, but when I'm standing on the starting line, there's no place in the world I'd rather be. Having those thoughts before my races is extremely important for me. They remind me that I'm ready to go and that I enjoy what I'm doing. Aside from racing, I've learned to really enjoy the act of just going for a run, Kellogg says. While there's nothing better than nailing a good workout or smashing a PR, there's something therapeutic about going for an easy 10-miler. Just why do Kellogg and the rest of us find an easy 10-miler so therapeutic, such a pleasurable interlude from the demands of the workaday world? Running's effects on our short-term emotional state, or mood, is our next topic. Chapter 4. How to Use Running to Improve Your Mood. Sunday, February 12th, may have been the most unusual day of 2017 for me. I ran for 70 minutes, nothing out of the ordinary there. The logistics of the run were also typical for winter in Maine. I had stabilizers on my shoes because of the previous days, as well as currently falling snow, and I did short loops of a nearby neighborhood that gets slightly better plowing. Even my falling a few times didn't really distinguish the run. What made the day unique was that I returned from the run in a worse mood. This absolutely sucked, my running log entry begins. Heavier snow was forecast for the next few days, so I'd wanted to get in something other than a token run. More important, decades of doing so had taught me that even on runs that were drudgery, my mood would improve if I stayed out long enough. But not this day. As I flailed around Ferry Village, it felt as if every driver who passed me was more likely than the last to get flipped off. Every slight I'd recently received turned out upon examination to be even worse than I'd originally perceived, and every subsequent mile was that much more an example of the pointless, endless obligations I'd let my life become. Fortunately, runs like that are a once-every-few-years phenomenon. Running is the simplest, most effective way I know to go from sour to sunny in a short time. It's not the promise of a better mood that gets me out the door on difficult days. It's the near guarantee that I'll return home in a better mood. In previous chapters, we looked at some of the long-term brain changes that running can cause. These are powerful, desirable consequences of being a runner. But on any given day, especially the tough ones, you're not concerned about the size of your hippocampus or recent gains in neuroplasticity. You just want to feel better. Running's effect on mood, how it can quickly and substantially alter your perception of your current existence, is what this chapter is about. Mood and running. Mood is your subjective description of how you're feeling. In psychology, it's distinguished from emotion. Whereas emotion can be thought of as your acute reaction to a specific situation, anger, joy, disappointment, etc., mood is a broader, longer duration survey of your overall mental state. Certainly, events that spur emotions contribute to your mood. A thank you card from a friend might immediately produce such emotions as happiness and surprise, but might also have a positive effect on your mood for the rest of the day, even when you're not specifically thinking about the card. But your mood can change, even when the rest of the world stays the same. If you go for a run, afterward you'll probably be happier, feel calmer, and like people better, says Frank Brooks, Ph.D., a clinical social worker in Portland, Maine. That's you being in a better mood, because that's your experience of how you're operating in the world at that time. That Brooks, a non-runner, so accurately describes a typical post-run mood boost shows how well established the phenomenon is. Research overwhelmingly documents that people are in a better mood after exercising. That's the case for both types of good moods psychologists talk about. Positive high activation, such attributes as being alert, excited, elated, and happy, and positive low activation, such attributes as being content, serene, relaxed, and calm. Running's knack for boosting mood is one of its great calling cards, no matter the state of your mental health. But it's an especially strong hook for those of us with depression or anxiety. I cannot recall a study in which the post-exercise mood boost of people with and without depression were compared directly, says Iowa State Professor Pantaleimon Ekakakis. What I can tell you is that the feel-better effect of a bout of exercise that is found in non-depressed individuals is also found in depressed individuals, and for statistical reasons, you might assume that if you start lower, you might have more of a range to improve. That is, it's one thing to run for an hour and go from being in a good enough mood to a better one. It's a fundamental shift to go from being miserable to content. Almost every runner I talked with for this book gave some form of Cecilia Bidwell's statement. I'll finish a run and be like, wow, this is how most people feel all the time. The shift I get most days is from my default fault-finding with reality to what the seminal psychologist William James called the yes function. I'm more expansive, open, and engaged, less sour, dismissive, and despondent. Research on post-exercise mood boost comes with a caveat. You probably need to be in decent shape for the boost to be genuine. Consider a 2009 study from George Mason University that looked at mood changes in a group of depressed men and women. Immediately after a 25-minute treadmill session that included 15 minutes at a challenging pace while the treadmill was set at a 10% grade, the subjects said they were in a less depressed mood. But half an hour after the workout, they reported a more depressed mood and feeling less vigorous than was the case before the workout. Why the difference between that finding and the experience of so many runners with depression? The subjects in the George Mason study were sedentary. One of Ekakakis's contributions to exercise psychology was the insight to perform mood surveys not only when people are done exercising, but while they're working out. From doing so, he learned that most people, especially typical middle-aged people who tend to be overweight and have low cardiorespiratory fitness, feel worse while they exercise, he says. Then, once the exercise stops, there's a rebound effect. Thank goodness it stopped. For a few minutes after exercise, it may appear that they feel better than before they started. But that's just a bounce back from a feeling worse effect that happens during exercise. That's not usually the case with runners. We have the fitness needed to sustain activity below and just above what's known as the ventilatory threshold, which in practical terms Ekakakis defines as the point where you first start to notice a change in your respiration. Your respiration is no longer calm and irregular. It becomes deeper, more regular, more noticeable, and it changes your speaking patterns. In running terms, this is about the pace you could hold for an hour. If you're familiar with tempo runs, 3 to 6 miles at a comfortably hard effort level, you run them at around the intensity level Ekakakis is talking about. Time spent below and up to that intensity is associated with a feel-better effect, Ekakakis says. Unfit people might reach their ventilatory threshold getting off the couch and walking across the room, so any sustained exercise is likely to have them in duress and a worse mood for pretty much the entire workout. My Chemical Romance. How is it that getting in your miles boosts your mood? Most people, even non-runners, tend to give the same answer. Endorphins. In the 1970s, it became known that these chemicals, which bind to neuron receptors in the brain, are released at higher levels during a run. Several studies found that higher levels of post-run endorphins correlated to improved mood. At the height of the first running boom, endorphins became synonymous with another coinage familiar to non-runners, the runner's high. It needs to be said that the runner's high is an imprecise concept. Ask 5 people to define it and you're unlikely to achieve consensus. Is it an altered state where you lose track of time? A feeling of effortlessness? A state of flow? Euphoria? Being in a better mood than would seem logical given that you're working hard? The nature of research is such that scientists need agreed-upon definitions and measurable parameters. One research team has proposed runner's high be defined as a change in pain sensation, anxiety level, calmness, or feelings of well-being. While these criteria can be measured, running is hardly the only undertaking that can alter them. In general, we use runner's high as a catch-all to get people's attention so that they know what we're talking about more than an operational psychology state definition, says David Reichlin, Ph.D., a professor of anthropology at the University of Arizona who has researched runners' moods. After the initial popularization of endorphins, most people equated them with the runner's high, however they were defining it, and considered the matter settled. Back in the lab, however, doubts began to rise as to whether the correlation between endorphin levels and mood was meaningful. After all, endorphins are released by the pituitary gland, which is located at the base of the brain, but disperses its contents outside of the brain. If endorphins have anything to do with changing how you feel, it's probably the ones in the brain, not the ones in your peripheral circulation, Ekakakis says. A strong correlation between endorphin levels in the brain and improved mood wasn't demonstrated until 2008. German researchers used PET scans, an imaging study often used to check for cancer, on triathletes' brains while the triathletes ran for 2 hours. They found high levels of endorphins in the prefrontal cortex and other parts of the brain associated with mood, and that these levels aligned with the triathletes' reports of euphoria. By that time, endorphins were no longer considered the all-purpose explanation for why most runners are mentally refreshed after a run. They're not even the only potentially relevant brain chemical. As part of his research into human evolution, Reichlin has measured pre- and post-run endocannabinoid levels in runners, dogs, and ferrets. Endocannabinoids are substances that bind to the same receptors in the brain as THC, the primary substance responsible for a marijuana high. Reichlin has found increased levels of endocannabinoids in humans and dogs following a run, but not in ferrets. That result supports the born-to-run theory on the role of running in human evolution, because the ancestors of modern humans and dogs ran to obtain food, whereas ferrets didn't. A side note, Reichlin found that dogs' endocannabinoid levels decreased after they walked on a treadmill for 30 minutes. It might be the case that walking your dog around the neighborhood is necessary so that Spot can do his business, but that Spot would be happier if you took him running. Reichlin says there are two leading theories on why running causes increased levels of endorphins and endocannabinoids. Beginning around 1.8 to 2 million years ago, our ancestors shifted to a lifestyle that required a high level of physical activity. The changes that occur physiologically due to exercise likely are a product of that evolutionary history, he says. Endocannabinoids and opioids are analgesics, or pain relievers. It's very possible that during exercise, these neurotransmitters are activated for pain relief to allow you to move at a higher rate of speed. This would keep you moving for longer than you would without those, and a byproduct would be that it makes you feel good. Another possibility is that this is a way that natural selection might motivate a behavior that doesn't always seem to be the smartest thing to be doing when you're a hunter-gatherer. You expend a lot of energy running, and every calorie you expend, you've got to feed at some point, Reichlin continues. At this point, it's hard to figure out which of those is best supported. There's plenty of evidence from mouse models that if you do things to these neurotransmitter systems, like block them, mice that generally engage in a lot of wheel running stop doing that. So, that's suggestive that motivation is a real strong aspect of these systems. But that's not to say that we have a firm conclusion. Reichlin agreed when I asked whether his two explanations could have co-evolved. The way that natural selection works is that things that improve reproductive success are what stay in the gene pool. So, if a combination of analgesics and neurobiological rewards to make you feel good allow someone to be a better forager, then that's going to be selected. Of course, to be a successful hunter-gatherer, you need to be fit. It's hard to chase down an antelope or forage for 3 hours if you tire getting up from the Stone Age equivalent of a sofa. Reichlin's theory that feel-good brain chemicals are released during prolonged excursion meshes perfectly with the observation made earlier that runners and other trained endurance athletes have special access to mood improvement through exercise. Those brain chemicals are thought to also include such neurotransmitters as serotonin and brain-derived neurotropic factor, the protein cited in Chapter 1 as associated with exercise-induced improvements in brain function. Mood is more than a simple reflection of your current brain chemistry. When you run, your body temperature increases. Slight increases in core temperature can reduce muscle tension, which may lead to feeling more relaxed and calm, as you might be upon exiting a sauna. Body temperature can remain elevated for an hour or more after running, contributing to the afterglow effect. We tend to focus on the brain, and that's important, says J. Carson Smith, Ph.D. of the University of Maryland. But after exercise, the nervous system is quieter, your muscles are more relaxed, and that feeds information into your brain that you interpret as a good feeling, a state of calmness. And let's not forget the short-term version of self-efficacy. In Chapter 2, we saw how success in regularly reaching running goals, however modest, can spur a cognitive breakthrough towards life's challenges. On a day-to-day basis, post-run satisfaction with yourself for winning the battle with inertia and doing what you know is good for you can improve your mood. The best runs for mood boosts. What types of runs will best lift your mood? How far, how fast, when, and where should you run? Before we look at what research and best practices have to say on the matter, the most important part of the answer is a run that occurs. It's almost always the case that any run is better than no run. Rare is the person who goes to bed thinking, "I wish I hadn't run today." The opposite scenario is familiar to most of us, especially on mentally challenging days. Try to avoid an all-or-nothing view of running, says Brian Vasey, a clinical psychiatrist who has long used running to manage his depression and anxiety. "I used to think if I wasn't going 10 miles, it wasn't worth it," he says. "I'd have a lot of days where the thought of going that far was overwhelming, and I'd take the day off. That's not helpful." Ultramarathon star Rob Krar has also learned to overcome that approach on tough mental health days. "In the past, if I hadn't been able to get out and get done exactly what I wanted to get done, I'd be pretty hard on myself, and I'd consider myself a failure," he says. "Now, I'm more willing to say, okay, I'm not going to be able to do that 15-miler or track workout, and I might miss my mileage goal for the week, but I'm going to get my ass out the door for a 4-miler, even though it's nothing compared to what I'd hoped to do." I chuckled when Krar mentioned a 4-mile run. As I mentioned, I often used to be overwhelmed by the thought of being 5 miles from home and only halfway into a run. Those internal images sometimes resulted in taking the day off from running, which of course only made matters worse. Not only was I not getting the mood boost from a run, but I felt that much more defeated by the day because I had to put 0 miles didn't run in my log. I've learned to tell myself that a 4-miler has much more in common with a 10-miler than it does with a 0-miler. Most studies find significant mood boosts after 30 minutes of running. For me these days, that means going at least 4 miles. When I'm really struggling, I start with a flexible route that can be lengthened or shortened as feels most appropriate. I try not to make any real decisions on duration until I'm at least 15 minutes into the run. If it turns out I don't stay out much longer than that, I try to make the take-home message to self that I wasn't defeated because something is better than nothing, and tomorrow will likely be better. At the other end of the range, you may have experienced how long runs are especially effective in boosting mood. Remember, that study linking increased brain levels of endorphins with feelings of euphoria involved a 2-hour run. That was an appropriate duration for the highly trained athletes in the study. But, as with most things in running, what counts as a long run is relative. For you, it might be 40 minutes or 70 minutes, or whatever is a reasonable but significantly longer run than you do most days. Regardless of the length, it's the sort of run you'll feel above and beyond better after. When possible, I try to schedule things so that for the hour or two after a long run, I can enjoy feeling like what I assume is the norm for most people. How fast? In his research on mood-boosting endocannabinoids, Reichlin had runners do 30-minute workouts at 4 effort levels. He found the greatest increase in endocannabinoid levels after runs at 70% of maximum heart rate, which translates to jogging pace, and 80% of heart rate max, running at a steady conversational pace. Endocannabinoid levels decreased after Reichlin's runners sustained 50% max heart rate, walking, or ran for half an hour at 90% of max heart rate, close to 5K race pace for many runners. For endocannabinoids, at least, it's a happy coincidence that your standard getting in the miles pace appears to be most effective. Go out for a typical workaday run, and you'll return in a better mood. But as Reichlin himself says, "My biggest mood boosts are after tempo runs or intervals." Remember that there's more to mood than the levels of any one brain chemical. Pushing yourself through a hard workout can provide a needed sense of setting and accomplishing a goal. It's then often possible to apply that mindset to other areas of your life when things feel overwhelming. I find it comforting to tell myself, no matter what else happens today, I already got in 6 800-meter repeats. A Finnish study looking at opioid levels after different workout intensities is another reminder that brain chemistry doesn't necessarily trump all other contributors to mood. Researchers measured mood and opioid levels after people cycled at a moderate intensity for 60 minutes and after the subjects did a cycling interval workout after warming up, 5 all-out 30-second sprints with 4 minutes of rest or easy cycling between. Opioid levels were higher after the interval workout than after the moderately paced ride. But the subjects reported being in a better mood after the moderate workout. That these people had higher opioid levels after a harder workout, in contrast to the subjects in Reichland's study, further shows that opioid levels and mood aren't synonymous. Also consider a University of Wisconsin study that measured endocannabinoid levels and mood after people worked out at 70 to 75% of max, similar to one of the most effective levels in Reichland's research, and at a self-selected intensity. Symptoms of depression improved more when the subjects worked out at whatever intensity they wanted than when they followed the prescribed moderate intensity. The takeaway? When you're struggling to start or continue running, allow yourself to go as slow as you want. At the other end of the spectrum, if you feel good, go. When to run? For any runner, no matter the state of their mental health, the best time to run is when it's most likely to happen. The schedule of your non-running life is almost always going to be the final arbiter here. That schedule will likely influence not only the time of day, but how many days per week. As I mentioned in the introduction, if you run, you're a runner. There's no set number of runs per week that grants you access to or bars you from our ranks. But as I also said in the introduction, for most people, averaging at least 2 runs per week is a good minimum goal. That frequency will allow you to build the baseline aerobic fitness that Ekakakis and others note is necessary to get access to many of running's feel-better effects. As work and family obligations grow, many people find that running in the morning means less chance of things getting in the way and compromising the day's mileage. That's especially the case if you're running with others, which usually brings an added mood boost as well as help in not hitting the snooze button. Morning might be an especially effective time for those of us whose running is key to our day-to-day mental health. My first couple years of being an attorney, I ran in the evening, Cecilia Bidwell says. I loved those runs. It'd be like I'd come home super stressed out and would go for a run, and then I'd feel better. But I've learned running in the morning works better because my general level of anxiety is lower overall on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. It's kind of like I've taken my pill in the morning before things get bad. Krar says that during especially severe depressive episodes, morning runs are more effective than later ones. If I can do that earlier in the day, I feel better about myself and it sets the trend for the rest of the day. If I can keep the momentum for the rest of that day, I have a better chance of breaking out of that cycle. I used to do my main run on work days in the late afternoon or early evening. This practice was a holdover from my time as a high school and college runner. I would often do a short run of a few miles before work, but regardless of whether that happened, I would run an hour or longer after work. Through my late 30s, that schedule worked for me in terms of quality and quantity of training, as well as mental health benefits. Now that I'm in my 50s, I'm much more of a morning runner for 2 interrelated reasons. By the end of most workdays, I'm tired in a way that wasn't the case 25 years ago. I'm simply not going to head out for a 10-miler at 5:45 like I used to most afternoons. These days, if I don't run in the morning, my post-work runs are more like 4 to 6 miles, or 30 to 50 minutes. For me, that's my basic good-enough-for-today outing. You probably have a similar duration or length for what counts as a workaday run. Those runs are fine a few days a week, but when I string too many of them in a row, my mood suffers. I need a few longer runs to get more substantial relief, so I've switched primarily to running in the morning to make sure those extra effective runs happen. Where to run? As with time of day, the location of your runs is likely to be largely determined by real-life logistics. But when you have a choice, go for the most natural setting you can find. A lot of research has been done in recent years on the psychological response to exercise in various environments: forests, urban parks, city streets, indoors, and so on. It appears that green spaces have a much more beneficial impact, says Reichlin. Indeed, research out of the University of Glasgow found that people who were frequently active in forests had about half the risk of poor mental health as people who didn't regularly play in the woods. For any one run, people usually report better mood improvement, more tranquility, greater reduction in stress, anxiety, and depression in natural settings compared to populated human-made environments. One review of research on the topic found that green space boosts were even greater when there was a water view. Neurology researcher Jeffrey Burns, MD, does a lot of his running on the treadmill during the Kansas winter. "I don't feel like I get the same benefit from that as I do from being out and letting my mind go free and being outdoors," he says, of choosing Netflix over nature. Burns's experience meshes with mine. "In the last 4 years, I've run once for all of 10 minutes on the treadmill in my garage. Despite facing frequent winter conditions like those described at the beginning of this chapter, overall it helps my head more to get outside." Nature need not be miles from civilization. A 2013 study found that subjects' brains entered a more meditative state when they moved from a typical city setting to a public green space. Researchers had people do a 25-minute walk through Edinburgh, Scotland, while wearing a device that monitored their brainwaves. The walkers started in a shopping district that has 19th-century buildings and light traffic. From there, they walked to a park. After a stroll there, they ended by walking through a busy commercial district that has lots of traffic and noise. The walkers' brain activity varied greatly during their tour of the three urban environments. In moving from the shopping district to the park, brain activity associated with frustration, engagement, and long-term arousal fell, while activity associated with meditation rose. That changed when the walkers left the park and moved through the busy, loud commercial district. In that latter setting, one type of brain activity, engagement or alertness with directed attention, the researchers called it, dominated. Another chit in nature's favor? In one study, when cyclists rode a busy urban route with moderate pollution, their levels of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, the miracle grow of the brain, didn't rise, in contrast to when they rode in a non-polluted setting. Natural settings can also foster mental freshness. The trails I run on are typical for New England, with roots and rocks permeating the ground. I have to stay focused on my next 4 footsteps if I want to stay upright, and that makes it more or less impossible to once again examine all of life's deficiencies. During the half of the year, when the trails are covered in leaves or snow, I miss this guaranteed reprieve from rumination. Ultramarathoner Krar lives a short jog from a trailhead in Flagstaff, Arizona. Most of us have to make more of an effort to bathe ourselves in nature. But when circumstances allow, make that effort. Drive to the woods on weekends. Book hotels near parks when traveling. As they say at my neighborhood bakery, treat yourself. Don't cheat yourself. What to listen to? Do you listen to music when you run is a common question from non-runners. I don't, but that's simply a matter of preference, not some claim on my part of running purity. Music is one of my main sources of pleasure in life, as is running, yet I usually find that combining the two detracts from, rather than complements, my enjoyment of each. But that's just me. As in most of running, you should experiment to find what works for you, and then not worry what that supposedly says about you as a runner. A large body of research shows that music can help several types of athletic performance. For aerobic exercise at low to moderate intensities, music can lower your perceived effort. The same pace might feel a little easier when you listen to music than when you don't. This finding is the most pertinent to whether listening to music when you run can better boost your mood. First, if you enjoy a run more, you'll probably feel better about it afterward. Second, if listening to music makes running feel easier, you might stay out longer, which should lead to greater levels of feel-good brain chemicals. You don't hear about the swimmer's high. Is there something uniquely effective about running for managing mental health? Or can any form of exercise provide similar relief? The short answer is nobody knows for sure, and definitive research comparing the mood-boosting properties of various ways of working out is unlikely. Such a study would have multiple arms, optimal intensity, duration, or frequency of different forms of exercise. So you go from a study costing $1 million to $3 million, Ekikakis says. The pharmaceutical companies fund their own studies, but who is going to fund the exercise studies? The amount of government funding available is simply not at that level. Indeed, according to the World Health Organization, while depression is the leading cause of disability and bad health worldwide, on average, only 3% of government health budgets is spent on mental health issues. In terms of comparative research, the scant amount that's been done mostly consists of mood surveys of different groups of people before and after a variety of activities. That is, the people in one group might swim, others might lift weights, and others might walk. In one of the first such studies, researchers conducted mood surveys throughout a semester for undergraduate students in four different classes: introductory psychology, jogging and conditioning, weight training, and aerobic dance. Yes, the study was done in the 1980s. Over the course of the semester, the runners and aerobic dancers regularly reported slightly better moods than the weightlifters, and all three active groups had better mood profiles than the sedentary psych students. Overall, aerobic exercise seems more effective than strength training. Although people report improved mood after lifting weights, much of that could stem from self-efficacy. Good for me for pushing myself like that. Strength training, after all, doesn't induce that sustained aerobic effort that's associated with what Ekikakis calls the feel-better effect. Indeed, a 2016 review of research found that people with low levels of cardiovascular fitness were at greater risk of developing depression. It is safe to say that purposeful exercise is better than incidental physical activity. A study published in 2017 recorded subjects' moods over the course of a week as they exercised and engaged in what the researchers called non-exercise activity, such as climbing stairs. Predictably, their moods improved after working out. Daily living activities not only didn't boost mood, but decreased feelings of calmness. These various studies are interesting, but don't get at what we're really interested in. How would the same people describe their mood after doing different forms of exercise? Obviously, we're dealing with a self-selected population here, but the people I talked with for this book overwhelmingly supported the singular effectiveness of running. I've dabbled with triathlons a little, says longtime depression sufferer Rich Harfst. I've done yoga, I've done cycling. Nothing is the same as running. Cecilia Bidwell says that when she doesn't run, her anxiety puts her basic state at a 4 out of 10. Running normally gets me to an 8, she says. When I'm hurt and swim instead, I'm at 6. Heather Johnson notes an important appeal of running over other activities. Running allows for a greater personal connection with others, she says. It's hard to really get to know someone while swimming, dodging cars on a bike, or doing burpees. I think part of the depressed feelings I feel when I can't run may be the missing social connection. When I asked David Reichlin about running compared to other activities, he began by citing research. An early paper in endocannabinoid literature made the suggestion that the analgesic trigger was the mechanical pain associated with running, and that may be why swimming doesn't seem to have as big an effect, he says. It may be that the boost from analgesic triggers is more beneficial from some sports than others. That is, the same pounding that can lead to running injuries might also result in more of a mood boost, because it spurs your body to release its natural pain relievers more than activities with fewer impact forces. But then the practical runner in Reichlin took over. It's much easier to get yourself into a reasonable intensity while running compared to a lot of other sports, he continues. It's not too difficult to get in the right zone and stay there. You have a lot more control over your speed than even in something like cycling, where your effort level is more dictated by the topography or even stoplights. Also, unlike such activities as swimming or Nordic skiing, running doesn't require learning technique well enough to sustain the right effort level. The University of Maryland's J. Carson Smith offers an intriguing theory. One thing that distinguishes running is the feedback that's received by pounding on your feet. Studies in mice show that there are direct neural pathways that respond to the foot hitting the ground. They send information that is eventually communicated to the sympathetic nervous systems of the brain. And that feedback has an influence on how those brain regions are storing, synthesizing, and releasing neurotransmitters like serotonin. Krar, who cycles and competes in ski mountaineering, agrees about the primacy of running. Ski mountaineering is much more an anaerobic effort than running. It's much harder to find that flow state and go on and on at a comfortable meditative pace. Mountain biking is loud, it's mechanical, it's not as free and natural. Running is that perfect balance where you can push yourself as hard as you like, and it's easier to get into that flow state, problem solve, be one with nature, and hear your breathing and footsteps. My longest experiment with other activities came in the first half of 2013, before and after foot surgery. Mostly, I cycled 10 to 12 hours a week on a trainer in the basement. I rode outside as well, but indoors gave me much greater control over my effort level for the reasons Reichlin cites. I thought of each pedal stroke as a stitch in a safety net that would keep my day-to-day mood from sinking too low. But there was little in the way of the acute spikes I feel during or after running. Staring at the basement wall an hour or two a day was simply something that needed to be done to stay sane and fit. I wound up not running for 5 months. Since I started in 1979, the longest I'd previously gone without a run was 2 weeks. When, in September 2013, I ran for an hour for the first time in 9 months, I cried afterward. I knew I again had access to the most reliable, convenient, and immediate source of relief from my depression. Chapter 5. Running and Antidepressants. In the late spring of 1994, Alberto Salazar made running headlines for the first time in years. A dozen years before, he'd been one of the world's top distance runners, with 3 straight wins at the New York City Marathon, one in a then world best, and the celebrated Duel in the Sun victory by 2 seconds at the 1982 Boston Marathon. Never the prettiest runner to watch, Salazar succeeded in part by sheer force of will, epitomized by pushing himself so hard 1 year at the Falmouth Road Race that he was administered last rites. Salazar's body eventually began to betray him. In 1983, he placed 5th in a couple of international marathons, still excellent performances, but not the dominance fans had come to expect. And he placed last in the 10,000-meter final of the World Championships. In 1984, he was outkicked for the win at the U.S. Olympic Marathon Trials by a then-unknown Pete Fitzinger, whose personal best was more than 3 minutes slower than Salazar's. In the Olympic marathon, Salazar was never a factor. Running with uncharacteristic caution, he placed 15th, beaten again by Fitzinger. Salazar gave up marathoning, got slower and slower in shorter races, and eventually stopped competing. Imagine the surprise, then, in late May 1994, when word began to trickle out that Salazar had won the Comrades Marathon in South Africa, a 56-mile race that's arguably the most prestigious ultramarathon in the world. Imagine further the surprise when, in post-race interviews, Salazar ascribed some of his resurgence to the antidepressant medication Prozac. "It had an almost immediate effect on my general overall health," Salazar told me in 1994 for an article in the now-defunct magazine Running Times. "My ability to handle stress was back to where it used to be, and my energy levels went way up." He said he began taking Prozac on the recommendation of two doctors to restore his energy levels. "I never felt depressed," Salazar said about his pre-Prozac condition, "but I felt like life was harder than it should be. I always saw myself as a type A person who thrived on doing a lot, but now I was just tired all the time." He told me he started feeling better and running better just 3 days after going on Prozac. Salazar's story struck me in two ways. First, in researching to write about the topic, I read a lot about symptoms of depression. In the pre-Google age, finding DIY diagnostics wasn't as easy as it is now. I looked over lists of symptoms, which included such things as hopelessness, lethargy, and lack of interest in ordinary activities, and paused. Didn't everyone feel this way most of the time? My default state isn't the norm. The process led to more reading and set into motion the realization of my own long-time condition that I've detailed elsewhere in this book. My second takeaway from Salazar's story: I can take a pill and feel better? And my running will improve? Sign me up! In the 2+ decades since, the intersection of antidepressants and running has become both much more common and much more nuanced. In this chapter, we'll look at what modern antidepressants aim to do and what's known, via research and anecdotal reports, about how they affect running. Antidepressants are everywhere. Salazar was an early adopter of the modern class of antidepressants known as selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, often called SSRIs. Some well-known modern antidepressants aren't SSRIs. We'll get to that in the next section. These antidepressants are now typically prescribed before older classes, such as tricyclics, are tried, because the older drugs usually have greater side effects. These days, the drugs are far from obscure. According to the most recent data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, antidepressants are among the three most commonly prescribed classes of drugs in the United States. The other two are pain relievers and medications for high cholesterol. Between 2011 and 2014, 12.7% of Americans aged 12 or older reported taking an antidepressant in the previous month. That was a significant increase from 1999, when the equivalent figure was 7.7%. Antidepressant use varies greatly by age and gender. In the CDC data, women are almost twice as likely as men to report using an antidepressant in the previous month, 16.5% to 8.6%. Usage climbs with age, 3.4% in people ages 12 to 19, 7.8% for ages 20 to 39, 16.6% for ages 40 to 59, and 19.1% for ages 60 and over. There are also differences by ethnic origin. In the CDC data, non-Hispanic whites are 5 times more likely than non-Hispanic Asians to have taken antidepressants in the past month, 16.5% and 3.3%, respectively, and 3 times more likely than Hispanics, 5.0%, and non-Hispanic blacks, 5.6%. The highest usage appears to be among non-Hispanic white women, 21.4%, and women aged 60 and over, 24.4%. Current usage trends indicate Americans view antidepressants as a long-term medication. The CDC finds that of people who take an antidepressant, 44% report doing so for at least the last 5 years. A quarter of antidepressant users say they've been on medication for 10 or more years. The CDC numbers don't break down usage by income. That information would likely support the contention of Pantoliman Ekakakis, a professor at Iowa State University, that antidepressants are both over- and under-prescribed in the United States. The majority of antidepressants in the United States are given to people for non-depression-related diagnoses, he says. They're prescribed for all kinds of things: fatigue, fibromyalgia, eating disorders, obsessive-compulsive disorder, anxiety. A 2009 study found that almost 80% of antidepressant prescriptions are written by physicians other than psychiatrists. The pharmaceutical companies have created this impression that antidepressants might help, but they generally don't hurt anybody, Ekakakis says. So some physicians will say, I'll give you something else for whatever you have, but I'm also going to give you an antidepressant, just in case. In the U.S., only about 25% of prescriptions are based on depression-specific complaints or a depression diagnosis. In that sense, they're over-prescribed. But there's not the same approach with people who don't have good insurance coverage, Ekakakis continues. In the lower socioeconomic strata, where depression is likely to be more prevalent, antidepressants are under-prescribed. How antidepressants work. The popularity of modern antidepressants is especially striking when you consider that experts aren't sure exactly why they work. Although SSRIs are commonly used to represent all modern antidepressants, there are newer types that affect the reuptake of other neurotransmitters besides serotonin. SNRIs work on both serotonin and norepinephrine. Examples include Effexor and Cymbalta. Bupropion, which is the generic name for Wellbutrin, is a norepinephrine dopamine reuptake inhibitor, NDRI. In this chapter, I'll mostly use brand names of antidepressants. What these drugs have in common is that they're designed to change the behavior of neurotransmitters, which are chemicals that help brain cells communicate. Specifically, antidepressants keep neurotransmitters thought to be associated with mood regulation from getting immediately reabsorbed into the brain's nerve cells after they've done their transmission work, hence reuptake inhibitor. For example, the drugs may keep serotonin in the space between nerve cells, or synapses, for longer. The increased presence of neurotransmitters in synapses is thought to spur other activity in the brain that leads to a reduction in the symptoms of depression. The surprising part is that people are not quite sure how these changes in neurotransmission link to depression, Ekakakis says. As we saw in Chapter 2, it appears that depression is linked with shrinkage in the area of the brain called the hippocampus, which is primarily involved with memory. In people who take antidepressants, the hippocampus tends to show neuroplasticity, or the creation of new neurons, and an increase in the size of the hippocampus. The degree of the neuroplasticity and the degree of the size of the restoration of the hippocampus appears to be related to the antidepressant effect, explains Ekakakis. The reason I say it's complicated is because we don't understand why an area of the brain that appears to be involved with memory would somehow contribute to an antidepressant effect. If those brain changes sound familiar, that's because they're the same ones often found in depressed people who start exercising. Antidepressants, in other words, appear to improve the same part of the brain that running is thought to. There's also debate about how well antidepressants work, and for whom. Studies on the drug's effectiveness usually focus on reduction of symptoms, for example, feeling sad less often, rather than broader outcomes, for example, functioning well in everyday life. Whether that difference bothers you probably depends in part on what you expect from antidepressants, to make life more bearable versus to make you depression-free. I lean strongly